Hello, this is another podcast as I'm going for a cardiac rehabilitation walk. I had an operation about 5 months ago and I'm doing fine, just walking along. Now this time I want to talk about a fairly complex topic of snowflakes. I've talked about salt crystals growing, and they require a bit of observation to see what's going on. Snowflakes, this is a really tricky idea. Everyone has got the idea of that classic Christmas card snowflake with six lines of symmetry. So this is a science podcast in Peter Hill Explains, where I talk about things scientific. So I hope things go well on this one. So as a molecular physicist, I'm really fascinated by the fact of how a complex shape can actually grow out of thin air, so to speak. And the question you do ask is, there's obviously material going on each of those six branches of the snowflake. So how does it know, how does it get the template to grow down one arm from the other arms? And you have this fundamental question, what's going on here? So there must be some sort of energy transfer from the arms, which sort of act as a template for the snowflake to continue to grow. This is very interesting. So this must mean that because of the molecular forces, it can't be individual molecular forces, it's probably some sort of vibration going through the snowflake. Let's look at snowflakes in general, the history of them. And they are really the icon of science. And there's this coined term from, I think, an original person in Vermont, I do remember, who made a lifetime living of photographing in the very early cameras with a microscope snowflakes which fell down. Now, of course, he wasn't a scientist. He was an enthusiast, and he would only photograph perfect snowflakes. So he would look at the snowflake. If it wasn't perfect, he wouldn't photograph it. And so a lot of people get the impression that all snowflakes are perfect as they fall down. And indeed, they can be. This is one of the false impressions people have, is that all snowflakes are perfect. People who actually do photograph real ones as they come down see that you get a whole series of different things happening. Them are asymmetrical, and a lot of them are just rammed together. So if you get several snowflakes hitting each other, they'll stick and you'll form a conglomerate, sort of a mini little mess of snowflakes together. So this is one of the first things you have to deal with, is that the snowflake itself that we imagine is a science construct. It's a science marketing construct, but nonetheless it does exist, and there's a fundamental structure to them. Even though you look at them, there's a central hexagonal core. Now, this occurs so that you've got the central hexagonal core, and this occurs when your initial snowflake, the actual core, forms. And so this is a very small, miniaturized hexagon at the center of your snowflake. You notice that you always draw it. And to get this, we have to understand a few ideas. There is something which happens to a micro droplet of supercooled water. So this is a snow dropper, or a water drop, a raindrop. And what's happened is that the temperature around it has actually dropped beneath the freezing point, but the water molecules don't have a nucleation point, a way of actually freezing. the disorder. It needs an ordering point for freezing to occur. Now, freezing occurs when the water molecules stop writhing around each other and actually sit in a hexagonal orientation. So how this actually happens is a little supercooled rain droplet, which we would all recognize in Australia, because we don't get very much snow, as the start of a hail droplet. So hail droplets and snow droplets start the same way. They nucleate or form on a piece of polymer or a piece of dirt in the atmosphere. Let's take a little sidestep now to talk about hail, something which we get more of in Australia. If you get a hailstone and you actually pick it up and cut it across, look at it under a microscope, a polarizing microscope, you can see that it's an onion shell. And what's actually happened is this hail drop is actually gone through the atmosphere. It's pulling down. Let's start off a bit more. What happens is in a hailstorm. I can't really stop here. You're going to have to listen to an Australian coal train going through the Blue Mountains. Ashamed to say that we still mine some coal, but we are sort of rapidly moving away from it, thanks to your mate in the United States, Elon Musk, who's just going gangbusters, selling batteries to us all. And we're building sort of large solar farms everywhere. But it's still coming through. Okay, so what actually happens is that when you've got water vapor and rain, and when rain hits the hot Australian landscape, the water, which was cool, says, oh, it's really hot, these rocks are really hot, and turns to steam. The steam shoots up into the sky. When I say steam, I actually do mean water vapor, but this is invisible water vapor. It's not a cloud, it shoots up into the sky, and as it's going up, it condenses, and when it condenses, the water molecules get pulled out of the atmosphere into little drops, and this creates a vacuum. So a storm cloud, which a thunderstorm which rolls across the Australian landscape, at least, is extracting big time energy out of the hot land, and the rain goes up into the upper atmosphere. It's hoovered up, a little Dysoned upwards, pulled upwards, and it creates such an updraft that it continues going up as rain into the stratosphere, and the surrounding temperature of the water drops, and the water loses energy. It still remains liquid, and if it touches anything, it will turn to ice. Now, in Australia, obviously, there's a lot of dust around the place. The dust gets swept up, and indeed, if you cut open any hailstone, you'll see a tiny speck of dust. You have to look for it in your microscope, or if you're lucky, you'll see a small insect. I've seen small insects, but we do have, and if you should check this up on the internet, you'll get small little frogs and even fish actually being sucked up into the hailstones. So it will actually rain these little bacteria. Now, I suppose it is an important point that biological systems actually emit bacteria, which nucleate rain and encourage rain to occur through this process. So the same sort of process goes, and rather than forming a hailstone, the first little droplet lands on the pollen particle, or small little particle, and it, rather than forming an amorphous ice drop, it forms a little crystal, And the crystal obviously has this hexagonal and it has energy points. Now, in the growing, this poor person's walking up. G'day. And it has energy points with it. Now, if the ice particle... one would assume that the following thing must happen. There must be a greater number of dust particles than water drops, because you need a predominance of these ice crystals not to hit in another water drop. So if they hit another water drop, it will go down the line of producing a hailstone. Now, so if you've got a lot more dust particles up there than water droplets, the likeliness is that you'll only get a whole lot of these crystals growing. Now, the next step here, you've got to have this strange condition. One of the things we want to point out is that the formation of ice, a lot of energy is released as the water molecules slip into position, and a lot of latent heat is produced. So when this process happens, the actual process releases heat energy as the ice is formed, and you will notice sometimes often people say if it's snowing, it feels suddenly warm because you're getting a release of energy from the water freezing. So water freezing releases heat. Just try to get your mind around that. So ice melting removes heat, but water freezing releases heat. Okay, it's very dark in this part of the Australian bush. As I'm walking, so I'll probably see some possums and some other wildlife. And is that a big spider? It's a huge... Oh, my God, I'm not going to walk down here. There are these huge spiders falling across the paths. It's sort of a nightmare scenario. Now, what is it? The new moon is just around on the horizon. Not a new moon, a full moon. We've just had an eclipse. Lunar eclipse, so it's going to be a full moon around here, but it hasn't risen, so it's actually probably going to be quite dangerous to walk in the bush. It's not sort of, there's no lethal spiders there, but it's pretty yuck at this time with the still weather that all the spiders are out. We've got these crystals forming, and we have reason that there's got to be sufficient particles there, that the predominant position is that you have these water, supercooled water particles, and heat is being generated. Now, in my mind, this heat generating would actually start to reverse the conditions for these supercooled droplets and fill the air again with the water vapor, cold water vapor. Now, the next process which happens is that individual spikes come up out of in the vertices. So we have a process here, and I'm trying to get my mind around it, of the actual around your hexagon, you get these spikes going out. So your next phase of ice crystal growing is these spikes growing. Now, how does the water molecule get onto the end of these spikes? Now, you could say that the water molecule bounces around and it it just won't stick anywhere except at the end of these spikes. Now, I think that might be possible, but I think it's unlikely. I think there's got to be some sort of transportation mechanism that when a molecule hits the ice crystal in general, it is free to actually move on the surface such that it can actually reach these apex points in this case. Now, my ability to, or my belief in this, comes from the actual understanding of water itself. So let's have a little talk about water itself. So water is H2O, and the O is an oxygen molecule, and it's basically a tetrahedron shaped molecule. Oh, sorry, molecule atom. The atom's tetrahedral shaped, so it's got two electrons in the inner shell, the 1s, but the outer area is a hybrid 2 sp3 orbitals, and these orbitals form lobes which fill out the volume of a tetrahedral pyramid. Now, there's a car going past. Now, the result, now hopefully I'll be able to walk through this park without spiders getting everywhere. So these tetrahedral lobes have 6 electrons. They can actually pick up to 8 electrons. The 8 electrons will be from the hydrogen molecules, the hydrogen atoms or protons which sit there. The hydrogen atom is a proton and electron, so the electron will sit there, and the oxygen will be nice and complete. It will have 8 electrons around the outside. Now, the interesting thing as far as quantum mechanics is concerned is that the unfilled sp3 orbital will look from as far as the electron, sorry, as far as the oxygen, it will look as though the oxygen is positively charged. So it will be O2 minus. The electron will be actually able to be sucked through sort of a region of positive looking charge, and it will actually slip through the hydrogen atom. So what happens is that you have water's got 2 hydrogen hydrogens, but it's got 4 hydrogen bonding sites. So it's always so water itself is really a mixture of 2 gases, hydrogen plus gas and O2 minus gas. The 2 gases go between each other. And so if you imagine 2 water molecules, 2 oxygens of each, one will have a lobe, will have a proton in it, and another lobe will have electrons in it. And now, what of a second water molecule? And so what will happen is that there's something going through here at the night. Oh, it's goats. Okay, quite interesting to see. Okay, so the hydrogen proton will jump in to the next neighbouring water, and as it jumps in, that water will have too much charge and emit off another angle another proton, and that proton will jump onto the next and eventually come all the way around and fix the gap left from that proton leaving. So if you can imagine, the protons darts all the way around water all the time. Now, this is obviously not what you're taught at school. You're taught that a water molecule, those hydrogens are stuck to that water molecule, but they're not. And one of the things that you can do, if you're a physicist, you can get a little bit of heavy water, put it into a glass, and your deuterium will just race through that water because it just jumps from oxygen to oxygen as it's sort of shifted across. I think deuterium's not all that rare. I think it's on Earth it's around what is it, 1 in 3,000. Now, as you get closer to the sun, What the sun has done is it has boiled away the water. Now, deuterium has a very slight lower boiling point. It's slightly heavier. And deuterated water. And so what has happened is that the sun, the deuterium increases as you go towards the sun. I used to think the opposite happened, but the closer you get towards the sun, it's less volatile. So around the sun, you get a little bit more deuterium. So deuterium is still a hydrogen nucleus, but it's got a neutron added to it. So we'll just go back again. So I have this theory that you've got the frozen crystal, but water gas, when it lands onto the crystal, can link up and pair up and basically form a super-cooled liquid on the surface of the crystal. And by a complicated process of sticking to the crystal by hydrogen bonding and then sticking to other water molecules which are not quite sticking in slightly non-crystalline form, actually start to actually walk along the surface of the crystal. So when the water molecule starts to land on the crystal, rather than actually doing what they would normally do, forming an amorphous drop, the actual water molecule can actually walk, or groups of them can actually walk up to the spikes, and so that you see the spikes grow, and when they obviously grow, they will produce a heat source at the top, and you can imagine vibrations and stuff like that. Basically, it would, if it gets too far up one area, I could imagine it being less favourable. So on average, these spikes will grow at the same rate. So again, look, this is just speculation of a molecular physicist who would love to have some more time in the lab looking at it. So at this point in time, we have started off the pollen hit with the first liquid drop, forming a crystal. The crystal releases heat, and you've got several processes which shut down the number of liquid drops out there. So it actually reverses, the heat reverses, and your liquid drops, your supercooled liquids, disappear, and they start to reform as supercooled liquids on the crystal surface. But under the crystal surface, they will form a sort of a skin which will walk up to the crystal growing points. Now what happens after that is a really fascinating thing, is that you tend to get glass sheets going out from two types of things coming out from those spikes, those six spikes. Those spikes can continue to grow, but glass sheets grow out, or flat sheets of your fundamental crystal growth. Now, you've got to remember here that the crystals have a 24 symmetry. That is six, but they've got an equal amount of material above and below the frame, and an equal. So if you took any of those sticks, those spikes, you cut it out, that they're four-way symmetric. I just tried to get your mind around that. But you get these glass sheets growing. So if you look at it under time lapse, you see quite asymmetrically the glass sheets, these flat sheets which grow out from the surface of these crystals. And you can quite well imagine a build-up of this liquid, and for some reason, which I sort of believe has to be done, there's basically, as sheets grow up one area, on one of them, it sort of defines a regional boundary which the ice can grow at the other level, and it stops at a particular point in time before deciding to do something else. So it may actually decide to grow another spike, but again inside the plane, so you get this branching again, but again on the same 60-degree angles for the snow, so it's snowflake to grow. Now, we have the problem here of how does the ice crystal know, because you've got thousands of molecules, you know, absolutely millions of molecules between one point and the next, how can it actually transfer the information? And the only way that I can see it is the actual vibration modes of of one arm starts to actually communicate this vibrational energy and sort of subtly molds the maps that maps the energy. And so as you get more of this super cooled liquid forming on top of it, this grows your snowflake, and so eventually you'll get the perfect snowflake growing, but only if you have the conditions, I believe, of continual cooling and the supercooled liquid, which would form a supercooled liquid, which would form a hail drop, is stopped, and indeed it's actually growing quite neatly and uniformly on these snow crystals. Now, of course, if these snow crystals grow to a certain size and mix, they will stick to each other. You can imagine two crystals sticking to each other, and they will automatically bond and stick to each other. Now, one of the, I think, the interesting things that I deduce is that if two snowflakes touch each other, you would normally think they would smash each other apart or bounce apart, and they probably do, but then you'd have little flakes, but you know, you'd have sort of injured snowflakes going about. But what in actual fact happens is that you've got this sort of liquid glue on the surface of the snowflake growing all the time, and so when it encounters another snowflake touching together, it glues it all together in a conglomerate, so you've got the actual overall snowflake growing. And this for me answers a sort of a major problem of crystal growth. So I've I suppose specialised looking at how buckyballs and carbon grows. Well, one of the more interesting things is that you have a problem that the water molecule in free space is spinning. It's interesting in terms of quantum mechanics. If you freeze a water molecule down, you can actually stop it spinning in space. That's when the translational energy, or the actual overall temperature, is beneath its lowest vibrational, or sorry, rotational level. But however, you've got this problem that obviously when the molecule actually reaches your point, you've got to stop it spinning, it to lock in place. And with water, it's a little bit easier because you've got the protons leaving all the time. But you've got this fundamental problem that you've got to have the conservation of rotational angular momentum of the gas as transferred onto the crystal. Now, overall, that's perhaps not such a major problem, because the average rotational angular momentum of a gas is on average zero. It's actually, unless it's actually the whole gas itself is swirling. But I'll just close this off by talking a bit about, I suppose, force fields, crystal force fields, and molecules approaching crystal force fields. One of the interesting things, there's a frog. It's a nice frog there. You have the problem of oxygen molecule, several oxygen molecules landing on the heme molecule. So your blood cell is basically this huge bucket or bag of heme molecules. And the heme molecules is a beautifully highly sprung bed. And so it's got the iron which it locks with, and the iron is actually held in these proteins. And there's something about it that the oxygen doesn't bond with the iron, it actually sticks close to the iron ore in the case of, I think it's animals with green blood, it's magnesium they have in the side there. So octopuses, I think snails have green blood. So if it's green blood, it's typically a magnesium iron in the centre. But so you've got this iron in the centre here, and what it has to do is that it's actually got to stop the oxygen molecule rotating, because it can't actually, you know, the oxygen molecule sitting in on the in that heme site can't be rotating. If it was rotating, there would be no bond possible. And it's also got to slow it down. So that water, that oxygen molecule, and it's slowed down by actually going into a trap, but it's got to hold it relatively well. And so the interesting thing is that you've got these other binding sites. I think there's a huge bat up here. These other binding sites where these other water molecules and other molecules stick to the heme molecule, and as the oxygen comes in, it goes to a lower potential energy and kicks off these other molecules. And it's interesting that the actual vibrational structure of the heme molecule transfers the rotational energy into, it sort of disperses other molecules. So it would be, I suppose it's really interesting that you would then get characteristics, adhesion of oxygen dependent on the temperature of the liquid or the quality of the liquid it was in, because that would determine the bond interactions, things that were sticking on the oxygen molecule. So it's really interesting. It's sort of like a form of molecular sweating that can lose energy. It has to be able to lose energy and angular momentum in order for the oxygen to come in. Now, interestingly, in a snowflake, all this complexity is not so necessary, as you have this potential interface. Now, can I warn you that all of this is based on, this is just a podcast. It is from a molecular physicist. I'm quite experienced, and I'm able to reason or view and see things, but it's not a scientific paper by any stretch of the matter. It's not by someone who's an authority in these times. This is just my speculation. And look, I really invite you to look at time-lapse pictures of snowflakes growing, and look into snowflakes, and consider what I've said. Does it make sense? Or is there other factors that you disagree with me? So this is just a science podcast, and I hope that's helped you understand. And it's very interesting for me, because I suppose it's just letting you into the world of someone who's really rather curious, and rather than just saying, oh, that's a pretty thing, it's really made me think. So hopefully if you're in that space, you've heard another person out there. So in the meantime, keep on doing science.